Hey, everybody, this is Kelly Mason and Leslie Carson, and you're listening to episode 5 of our Early Intervention Podcast. 5. Can you believe it? We have made one whole hand of podcasts, which is a big feat these days. It's the small things, right? Okay, let's get to it. Leslie, share with us what's in store for today's podcast.
Episode 5, titled Tiny Tummies, Big Questions, is with our guest, Dr. Bonnie Kroom. Dr. Kroom grew up in Abilene, Kansas, and she attended KU. Woohoo! We're happy about that. Then left the Midwest to complete both her pediatric residency and pediatric gastroenterology fellowship at Boston Children's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. Currently, Dr. Kroom is practicing in the Kansas City area as a pediatric gastroenterologist. But before we bring her on, hey, Kelly, tell me something good.
Tell me something good.
Yes, this story is about a former social worker in Canada and how he is enjoying his retirement in a very similar way to how he enjoyed his long career, by listening to people. Paul Jenkinson is currently on a cross-Canada tour where he shows up, sits down, and listens to anyone about anything. Good listening is a skill rarely found in the world, and during a career as a registered social worker, it was part of the job description. Jenkinson said, "I'm there as a fellow human to make connections. I just create that safe space for them, a little bit like the stranger on the airplane that you're never going to see again." How many people do you know who'd love someone that isn't a therapist or a family member to just sit down and talk to? He added that it's not all lost students and recovering addicts. Sometimes people just want to come express the things they're proud of or the good things they've performed, including volunteering for others, just like Jenkinson. There's no timeline, no topics barred, no charge, and no pressure, as well as a promise to keep everything confidential unless the speaker expresses the intention to harm themselves or others. Oh, and he doesn't have a home. Jenkinson isn't destitute. He's a transient with financial means and will come anywhere he's invited. And I just love this story because I think it's true that being a good listener is a skill that you often have to learn and practice. And I love how he compares himself to being the stranger on a plane. I thought about how many great conversations I've had with strangers on planes, and one even turned out to be my male doppelganger, Rusty, who lives in Colorado. Anyway, totally off topic, but this is just a reminder to myself, I think, that sometimes I just need to listen.
That's a great skill to have, great reminder. And thank you, Paul, for doing all of that. Well, welcome, Dr. Bonnie Kroom, and thank you for joining us today. We do have a variety of listeners here, and in education and medicine, we love using abbreviations, but could you share with us what GI actually stands for?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here and talk more about this topic. We really do love using abbreviations quite often, and mostly because everything in medicine has a really long name. GI stands for gastroenterology or gastrointestinal. So saying GI rolled off the tongue much easier. So a GI doctor takes care of issues related to the gastrointestinal or digestive tract, which starts in our mouth and goes all the way down to the bottom, but also involves organs including the liver and the pancreas.
Awesome. Well, thank you for joining us, and it's lovely to meet you. And I'm happy to hear that you're not a doctor of little plastic army men. Get it, G.I. Joes. Anyway, Father's Day was yesterday. I felt like I needed to throw in like a good dad joke in there. Can you share with us how you came to be a GI pediatric doctor? Was it something that you dreamed of as a small child, or just it came to you one day?
I think if you told me as a kid that I was going to grow up to be a doctor, I would have thought you were joking. As a young kid, I have a hearing difference, so a lot of my time was just spent figuring out how to communicate in a typical society. I grew up in a small town and no one in our family was really a physician or in that type of medicine. And so I never really would have pictured myself here. Granted, we're here, and that is probably a whole nother podcast and how I got here. But when it came to choosing a specialty, some of the best advice I was given in medicine was to go where you connect with the people the best. And maybe I'm biased, but I think pediatric GI has the best people I've ever worked with. And maybe it's just the comfort of talking about bodily matters. It just needs to be a good human. But it really is the people you work with is what make going to work very enjoyable along with the work itself. Medicine of GI is, of course, I find it very interesting. It feels like I'm applying some of the basic things that I learned in physiology to different disease processes. And the field is still very broad itself, too. I see newborns, but I also see young adults. I see very simple, straightforward problems to very complex problems with different settings. Sometimes I'm working in a clinic and have a little bit of a predictable day, or I'm taking care of kids at the inpatient setting, meaning they're in the hospital, they're admitted, never know what will come your way. But maybe I'm doing a procedure, so definitely keeps me on my toes every day, and I've enjoyed it.
That's great, and I love what you said about the people that you work with. That is really important.
Totally.
They're like a second family. Do you have any specific interests or passions related to pediatric GI? And if so, what are they?
I really enjoy being a general GI provider for the reason that I just mentioned with the variability. But I grow in my career and starting to develop more of a niche into taking care of children with feeding disorders and also aerodigestive disorders. So not only the GI tract, the issues that involve the upper and lower airway, and often children with feeding and aerodigestive disorders need a team with, you know, pulmonary, ear, nose, and throat, and feeding therapists and psychologists, nutritionists. And so I've really enjoyed teamwork in that manner. It encourages me to continue learning no matter what comes our way.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's great. Similar to what we kind of do here, teaming at Infant Toddler, which leads us into our next question. We know you've had your own experience working in early intervention in your home with your child. Do you mind sharing what that was like for you and your family?
Yeah, absolutely. I would describe it as very humbling. As a pediatrician, I initially felt defeated, knowing that I had some professional tools to try and help my daughter with, you know, drinking difficulties, actually. But I couldn't do it all, and I needed help. Going through the experience through early intervention services reminded me of all of the resources available in the community and my admiration and respect for other professionals in different capacities really grew. I try and take every experience as a parent into taking care of patients, but I think it helps provide more well-rounded and wholesome care for children because that's only one perspective of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I became a better therapist when I became a parent. And sometimes I think, wow, I can't believe I said that. If I think back to a really long time ago when I was first starting off as a therapist. Why is it important for us to have a good GI system, and how do GI issues impact infants and toddlers?
Again, maybe I'm biased, but I think the GI tract impacts everything and everything impacts the GI tract. I think people may underestimate how much the GI tract influences how you feel. I think there's more in younger kids or toddlers that maybe they're a little bit constipated, they're struggling to poop, and they're uncomfortable, they're distended, but they don't know how to express or articulate that. And so it may manifest itself as behavioral issue, their irritability. And again, that goes back to your GI tract. Abdominal pain is very prevalent. And if you're not feeling well, it can present itself in any way. The other important aspect of the GI tract is what you put into your body is what allows you to grow and have energy and feel good. So it does have a lot of application to how your whole body functioning.
I would agree with that for sure. What are some symptoms infants or toddlers may experience that would cause caregivers or parents to ask questions about their child's GI system?
That's a good question. The most common thing that we see is abdominal pain, or at least the perception of abdominal pain for the younger kiddos that can't otherwise express themselves. But we also see vomiting or reflux or atypical stooling patterns, whether that means they're constipated, infrequent, hard, painful stools, or the other end of the spectrum. Maybe they're doing too much or having blood in their stool. What's their nutritional status? Are they growing as they should be, as we expect? Are there any feeding difficulties? So these are a lot of common symptoms that we can see in the GI. field.
Well, kind of along the lines of that a little bit, thinking about the symptoms that you just mentioned, what are some diagnoses that have been correlated to GI issues or that are correlated with GI issues?
Yeah, so GI issue can arise in anyone. It can be healthy kiddos that are experiencing symptoms, but there are a couple of conditions where we may see GI symptoms more commonly, such as autism spectrum disorder. We see a lot of constipation and breathing difficulty, or patients that have trisomy 21 or Down syndrome that may also come with GI issues, or just really any genetic syndrome can impact your growth and your nutrition. So there's a lot of things to consider there too. Kids with autoimmune disorders of any sort, so type 1 diabetic, which is an autoimmune phenomena, is at risk for celiac disease, and there's other autoimmune GI conditions like inflammatory bowel disease that we may consider depending on the risk factors that are present in the patient.
So moving on to talking about poop, which we try to say at every podcast, what is considered normal stooling for breastfed babies?
So normal for breastfed baby, exclusively breastfed baby, very big baby. It can be normal to stool a couple of times a day, but maybe when they're a couple of months old, it could be normal to stool once a week, so to speak. What matters is their initial stooling history. When did they pass that first poop after they were born, called meconium? What was stooling like in the first couple of weeks? What's their overall demeanor? Are they happy or are they uncomfortable because they're struggling to poop? Are there other symptoms like hard stool, blood in their stool, vomiting, poor growth? What's their exam like? Do they have a soft belly? Does their anus look appropriate? So it's more than just the frequency of stooling that matters with breastfed baby.
Kind of looking at the big picture, multiple things when you're talking about that. Mm-hmm. What about formula-fed babies and toddlers?
So, yeah, with formula-fed baby, they tend to stool anywhere from a couple of times a day to maybe every other day or so, which can be true for toddlers too. And that first six months of life for formula-fed babies, it's a little bit more predictable because what they're eating day-to-day or drinking day-to-day is the same. The only difference may be the volume. Whereas with breastfed babies, the milk is not the same even in a single day. There's a little bit more variability. And then once you add solid to the mix, that also changes things because we don't eat the exact same thing every day or even the same quantity of the same thing every day. So that may lead to a little bit more variability in their stooling pattern. And again, it's about the whole picture. What is the frequency? What is the consistency of the stool? Are they uncomfortable? Are there any other symptoms associated with it?
What about blood in the stool? Is that normal or like when should it be a concern?
Fair. I would say blood in the stool really is never normal. That being said, it depends on how you define blood in the stool. There are tests that can detect microscopic or cold blood in the stool. When it comes to babies, it can be positive and up to a third of infants. So especially with babies, I tend to focus more on visible blood in the stool. And again, the big picture. What was the context? Are they having poor growth? Are they irritable? What's the consistency of the stool? What's in the diet? With infants, it typically reflects either intolerance to milk protein in the diet, which can be temporary, or maybe it's an anal fissure, like a little tear on the bottom. Or maybe mom breastfeeding, she had cracked bleeding nipples and baby swallow of that. So it's more about asking the other questions along the side of it. And that's what's going to determine my approach for those patients.
Oh, great. What about if chunks of food show up? What do you think about that?
Yummy. it depends because some food, like corn, has this indestructible shell. So almost everyone is going to see corn in their stool if they're digesting it, if they're eating it. But in other situations, chunks of food can be seen due to like rapid transit timing, travel fast through the GI tract, and it can be seen in toddler diarrhea. Or maybe kids are not chewing their food very well and just not getting digested. Or it could be a sign of malabsorption. So again, it's about the other pieces of the puzzle that really determine the next step.
Well, here we go with those abbreviations again. PPI, Yeah. Can you share with us what that stands for and what it is?
So PPIs are proton pump inhibitors. These are medications that are used to reduce the acid in the stomach and treat associated conditions with that. And the proton pump inhibitor, the PPI, is referring to the mechanism by which it reduces acid in the body.
So can you share with us a little bit about what the updated reflex protocols and potential long-term side effects of PPI are?
Yeah, so it's reflux and it's pediatric. It's important to separate baby or infant reflux from reflux in children, older children, and adolescents. Because the key for infants is that it's often not related to the acid produced by the stomach. It's the physiology and anatomy of having a small infant with a short esophagus, therefore less distance for things to travel up and out of the mouth. They're often in unfavorable position, like laying flat because they can't sit up yet. And babies just often don't have great tone yet. And as a result of that, their sphincter, which helps reduce reflux in general, just isn't robust yet. So there's a lot of factors that contribute to reflux and infant that's not related to acid. So the guidelines do not recommend acid-reducing medication as first-line treatment for babies with reflux. And there have not been any placebo-controlled trials that have recommended that or have demonstrated benefits. And yeah, it is a generally safe medication, but it doesn't come without its risk. And that's the risk can include increased risk of infection, impaired bone health, and especially in infants, higher risk of developing food allergy down the line. You want to be very cognizant of its use, especially if it might not provide any benefit for the infant. So typically for infant baby reflux, we're starting with thickened feed. We're trying to take advantage of gravity and keep things in the stomach and less volume coming up. Next line is using a more broken down formula called a hydroxylase, or even more broken down amino acid formula. These are the protein in these formulas, the more smaller and more digestible, which is often also used to treat milk protein intolerance in infants because they can't express or articulate themselves. We don't really know what the underlying process is going on all the time. So it can be helpful to do that as well. But if you have an older child or an adolescent, that's a different story. Maybe it is an acid problem. And so the history is really important. So we have a teenager who's drinking energy drinks every morning and having burgers and fries in the evening. Well, I think there's some things that we can do before we jump to medication. You know, exercise, conditioning, dietary changes, sleep hygiene. I think people often underestimate how poor sleep impacts your perception of pain and other symptoms. But sometimes doing these lifestyle changes don't really work. And if there's no big red flag that would prompt you to do an evaluation right away, this is when it's appropriate to do an empiric trial of medication such as the proton pump inhibitor.
So what are the recommendations for a length of time a baby, if they were on a PPI? I know that's not the recommendation right away, but what would be the length of time that a baby could be on a PPI?
It really depends. Empiric trial, meaning we're going, the history suggests you have acid reflux. We're going to try this medication and see if it helps, which is still information gathering when you do those trials. But the empiric trials are often a limited period of time. And it varies from practitioner to practitioner on how long they're going to define that trial. Sometimes it's, you know, 2 weeks if it, in theory, would work within 2 weeks, or 6 weeks, or 12 weeks. For the trial, if you're treating esophagitis, for example, we expect healing within a few months. And then you try and wean off of it. If you're unable to wean off of the medication, or it never actually helped in the first place, this is when we're thinking a little bit more. I'm talking about further evaluation, because if it is, like, what are we treating? Is this reflux? Or is this something that can mimic symptoms of reflux, like eosinophilic esophagitis, which, another mouthful, we have an abbreviation, EOE, which is essentially an allergic condition of the esophagus that can look like reflux. And the PPI can be a treatment for this. And so clarifying what your diagnosis is can also define the timeline or the duration of therapy for the patient. So, you know, someone who has EoE that does respond to PPI, they could be on it for years. And at that point, you're just monitoring for side effects. So it really depends on what the diagnosis is and how they respond.
Well, I feel like you might have answered this a little bit, but I will ask, what would be some signs, like if from a parent's perspective, that maybe a reflux medication isn't working?
Great question. It really depends on what symptoms prompted the suspicion for reflux. Were they vomiting a lot or averse, meaning not eating or being interested in eating or whatever symptom it was, if we're treating for it and it's not getting better, maybe it's not the right call here and we investigate further.
How much vomiting is normal? I'm going to say it's not normal, but I'm wondering if this is a question parents ask.
It's a fair question because I think reflux in babies often gets labeled as vomiting. Because you're right, vomiting isn't normal. So when I have a parent who's describing vomiting, I really try and dig for more of a descriptor and ask for videos if they have any. This is effortless stuff coming out of the mouth suddenly, small volume, maybe it's a little bit more reflux. Vomiting tends to be more forceful. Often it's a bit of retching for the unit. Typically in large volume, you've got everything coming up from your stomach. But seeing infant bit of reflux, regurgitation, whatever you want to call it, always looks more than it really is. And as long as those other factors that we look at, are they happy? What's their growth like? And there's a term of happy bitter that we may all be familiar with. And one of the phrases I have learned in fellowship is, it's a laundry problem. You know, it's not the most pleasant thing for a parent to hear when they're sleep deprived and tired and constantly doing laundry, but there is some truth in that statement.
I think it can be hard as a new parent to know because there's so many questions. So, you know, if I've got this kid that's spitting up a lot, how do I know when it's too much? How do, you know? Right. So, yeah, it's just hard.
That's what we're here for.
Yeah.
A lot of what I do for reflux baby for the most part, again, I'm getting the history and checking for the red flag, but at the end of the day, regardless of what it is, it's a lot of education and counseling.
Yeah. Moving on to a different topic that we talk quite a bit about with families that we work with is picky eating. When would you consider that a problem?
Also a great question. And I feel like everyone has a different definition of picky eating. You know, some pickiness can be developmentally normal. Generally, most infants accept most things offered up until about a year or so. And then a year and a half, they start to be picky, and that's when we're starting to see more teeth complaints of it. But that's not necessarily atypical. And some parents may say their kids are picky because they won't eat vegetables. But they eat fruits, which generally have the same nutrient profile and benefits as eating vegetables. And grains and proteins are generally well accepted by most toddlers. Think about your chicken nuggets, your chewing one. So when I've seen a picky eater, there's a couple of questions that come up. What's their growth like? Are they otherwise growing appropriately? But with that being said, just because they're growing well doesn't mean that they're meeting all of their needs when it comes to micronutrients. And so getting the history of what they're eating, their typical diet is also important. I really try and collaborate with dietitians when they're available to help me identify any gaps in their diet. But for the most part, we can replace these with multivitamins, minerals. So after growth and after nutrition, we look at their feeding skills. So this is where acne therapy is also really helpful. Are there any red flags such as difficulty swallowing or, you know, certain texture aversion, or they've been in feeding therapy persistently, but they're not making any progress? That's another aspect to consider. And then there's also psychosocial functioning. Like, how is this impacting their ability to function, be a member of society? Is this causing a lot of distress to the patient and their family? So there's a lot of aspects to consider when it comes to picky eating and how we define that and how aggressive to be depending on them.
How long would you say a child should receive feeding or swallowing therapy before a GI referral is made?
I don't think there's a magic number here. I think the history, growth, and nutrition impact the decision. There's no reason they can't be done in parallel. There are multidisciplinary clinics across the nation with GI, feeding, nutrition, psychologists, everyone evaluating the patient together so there can be shared and informed decisions about what's next for the patient. But I do recognize that that's not available everywhere. And so often these evaluations are done in isolation, but I trust the professional opinion of whoever they're evaluating. Mm-hmm. PD therapist does a single evaluation and they're like, whoa, there's some big red flags here in the referral. I take that seriously and I'll investigate. But sometimes it's, you know, recurring sessions and lack of progress. And so it really just depends on all of those other factors.
If a child is struggling with formula, how should parents decide on which formula to try next? I know you talked about this a few questions ago. What should they consider?
So formula marketing in 2025 is a bit overwhelming with all of these different choices. And if you add sleep deprivation and a fussy baby, on top of that, it seems like a really imperative and disrupting choice. In my practice, if I'm seeing a kid, they will refer for likely reflux or milk protein intolerance. So by the time they come to see me, I'm considering a formula, which I do have a few buckets that I consider. One is for reflux. It's considered an anti-reflux formula. You often have avid research to it, so they thicken on exposure to acid in the stomach, and that helps reduce the volume of stuff coming up. Also, another reason to try not to use acid depression in babies because for these added rice formulas, you actually want that to help activate the usefulness of it. I also use other more broken down formulas, the hydroxylate or amino acid formulas, especially if I'm concerned about poor growth because that can really help narrow that down. But in general, with formula changes, I really try and put a limit to it. Another problem with 2025 is the need for instant gratification, you know, wanting results right away. But the body doesn't always work like that. Sometimes you just need time to really decide if it's a failure. So I will sometimes see patients that will find a bone red within 2 weeks. I'm like, we don't know what was helpful and what doesn't. And it's, you know, a little bit confusing to the GI chart to do that. And so I really try and recommend that if we're going to make a formula change, we're going to try it for 2 weeks at least. Unless there's, you know, big red flag that the baby is developing an oral aversion, like they will not accept it. So I really try and, as hard as it can be for a parent, try and be patient through the process. Mm-hmm.
A big problem of 2025 is immediate gratification. I love that because I feel like Amazon might be a little bit responsible for that. We just want things right away, don't we?
Yes,
at least
we do.
My daughter does. She thinks they need to come right now. So thinking about different specialists in the medical field, when should a referral be made to a GI doctor and when would a referral to an allergy doctor be appropriate?
So this question does come up quite a bit when it comes to food intolerances versus allergy. And for the most part, a true food allergy is pretty obvious. You know, you've got rashes or hives, difficulty breathing, facial swelling. We're talking about anaphylaxis. That's a slam dunk. That should go to allergy. But there are also other conditions of food intolerances or sensitivities or even GI conditions that involve allergies, though. So these are the eosinophils that I'm talking about earlier. There's a cohort of GI diseases called, more abbreviation coming up, eosinophilic GI disorders, or EGIS, the most common one being EOE, as I mentioned earlier, so involving esophagus. But it can go anywhere in the GI tract. Or there's FPI. Abbreviation. We're on a theme here. Food protein-induced enterocolitis syndrome. This is a reaction to food, but it's not necessarily allergic. And then you've got calcium protein intolerance, which often gets dubbed as an allergy. So it can be a little bit confusing. You can totally see about who should go to GI, who should go to allergy. And I don't think they're mutually exclusive. Often GI and allergy have a great partnership and collaborate with each other, and some centers do have a multidisciplinary clinic with both providers embedded along with a dietitian. And so, but like a general rule, I would say is if the primary symptom is GI, meaning they're vomiting or they've got blood in their stores, they're having diarrhea, I think GI is appropriate for stuff there. And then we can collaborate with allergy and, you know, navigate what's going to be the appropriate medical home for these patients moving forward.
What can parents anticipate during the first visit with the GI doctor? And is there anything that they can do on their end that would be beneficial to the doctor?
Yeah. So in order to get to the root of the problem, we asked a lot of questions about what enters the body and what exits the body. So even just a few day recall of what they were eating and what their stooling pattern was like is really helpful. I love when I get pictures and videos because it gets me information that can be challenging to articulate and describe sometimes. It helped me understand the parent's perception of what they believe is happening, and we can communicate through and be like, okay, that happy bitter that I was mentioning earlier, I could see what that looks like and walk them through that. Or picture the stool, is it blood or is it food? I don't know. And sometimes the picture can be helpful too. I mean, I ask a lot of questions. At least I ask a lot of really nosy questions. But I also encourage parents to ask their own questions, too, to make sure at the end of the visit, we have a shared understanding of what's going on and what our care is going to be.
Well, Dr. Kroom, we want to thank you for being our guest on the Early Intervention Podcast and answering all of these questions related to GI, or if I want to use a big word, gastrointestinal. We truly enjoyed having you, and our brains feel bigger now after speaking with you. Thinking about our audience, which includes caregivers, therapists, and other community partners, is there a tip, strategy, or final thought that you would want to leave our listeners with?
I would say be comfortable with talking about the uncomfortable.
That's good. That is really good.
Well, as part of our podcast, we want to highlight someone or something as it relates to early intervention by giving them a shout out.
Today, our shout out goes to moms, dads, and those in a parenting role. In the U.S., we celebrated Mother's Day in May and Father's Day yesterday. We want to recognize the role parents play in the lives of their children. Parents play a crucial role in their child's development, as well as team members in the early intervention journey.
And that wraps up episode 5 of the Early Intervention Podcast. We hope you enjoyed our guest. Next month, we plan to talk to Sarah and Jay, and they plan to share with us about their early intervention journey with their daughter, Paisley, who is now 3. You can look for episode 6 to drop on August 1st, and you can listen to the Early Intervention Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube.
Feel free to email Leslie and I topics you are interested in hearing about, and you can send those emails to earlyinterventionpodcast@gmail.com. If I get an email from you, you will get a surprise from me. What that is, I don't know, but I'd really love to receive some emails. We would love to thank Friends of Infant Toddler Services for their support with this podcast. Friends of Infant Toddler Services, or FITS, develops, maintains, and funds additional services and programs for children served by Infant Toddler Services of Kansas, serving Johnson County. They are funded through private donations, fundraising events such as the annual Fall Ball Gala and Tee Off for Tots golf tournament, and through various grants. You can learn more about their work by visiting our website, itsjc.org. And it's time to say goodbye.
Until next time.